From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the dead face of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was enlarged and mounted in a gold frame by the Iraqi government, and the media displayed it like the trophy it was. NBC's Brian Williams.
Yeah, American children will see it during the dinner hour and ask who that is and why that man is in that state. It'll be shown around the world. It'll be shown notably around the Arab world.
It was another Iraq mission accomplished.
The ideology of terror has lost one of its most visible and aggressive leaders. Zarqawi's death is a severe blow to al-Qaeda.
But how severe is it? For 3 years, the Bush administration has portrayed Zarqawi as the evil nexus between al-Qaeda and the Iraqi insurgency. But other experts claim his role was inflated, both by the White House and by Zarqawi himself. It seems to have been in both their interests to enlarge the image of this small-time Jordanian crook turned jihadist turned terror mastermind. The question now is what image will survive him and how it will affect the war on terror. Bruce Hoffman holds the RAND Corporate Chair in Counterterrorism and Counterinsurgency and is editor-in-chief of the journal Studies in Conflict and Terrorism. He says Zarqawi would be thrilled with the coverage this week, given that 3 years ago he was a complete unknown.
And in a relatively short span of time, I think abetted by very clever use of 21st century media, the internet in particular, digital photography as well, that he was able to catapult to an infamous notoriety, but a notoriety where the Zarqawi brand was as well known as that of bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And I think probably today that he would take tremendous satisfaction as many people go online, laud him, praise him, and promise and pledge to avenge his death and to carry on the struggle.
Now, isn't the idea of the gilt-edged framed death portrait the very way that the Islamicist faithful lionize dead martyrs?
Yes, exactly. And I believe that was always Zarqawi's goal, is that he went to Iraq to become a martyr. And I think he understood that his martyrdom would ensure that he would have as great, if not greater, resonance in death as he has had in life. Otherwise, he would have been content to direct the insurgency from afar. But instead, he was fighting in the front lines.
So I could understand how the U.S. military might have a tin ear for this sort of imagery, but how in the world could the Iraqi military have, assuming this is a mistake, made such a mistake?
The highest imperative, of course, was to depict Zarqawi's death and to demonstrate to other Iraqis that their most homicidal enemy was dead and that this was a success of the security forces that are out to serve the people and protect the people. And I suspect in the rush to demonstrate that, attention may not have been paid to how his image conceivably could be interpreted or even used by his allies or active or even would-be supporters.
Now, as treacherous and deadly as he was, Zarqawi also was quite useful for the administration. The Washington Post reported a couple of months back, uncovering some documents suggesting that U.S. strategy was to intentionally overstate Zarqawi's role, presumably because he was a foreigner, a Jordanian, who operated under what he called al-Qaeda in Iraq, which lent credibility to the long-since discredited idea still clung to by the White House that Saddam Hussein was in league with al-Qaeda. With him out of the picture, won't it be harder for the administration to explain the violence and the chaos in Iraq?
Zarqawi, I think, often remained one step ahead of his opponents in that in recent months he deliberately refashioned his al-Qaeda organization in Iraq to be predominantly Iraqi. In fact, upwards of 90% of its members were Iraqi, in stark contrast to 3 years ago when probably the reverse percentage was foreign fighters to Iraqis. And in that sense, I think Zarqawi will leave a lasting legacy of having created, really, not quite single-handedly, but pretty much, an Iraqi domestic jihadi constituency, that even without him, you have Iraqis who were predominantly secular, now have been animated by his religious call and will carry on fighting even without the figurehead.
It's clear that Zarqawi positioned himself as a great religious warrior. And the U.S. administration portrayed him as a kind of evil mastermind. In the end, who do you think has won the PR war here?
Unfortunately, I suspect it's Zarqawi, because I think his fundamental message is, firstly, thug makes good, that you two can have a seismic effect on, indeed, history by resorting to acts of unmitigated violence and terrorism. I think he also, in a sense, comes ahead in the PR struggle because he demonstrated, especially with the grotesque beheading of Nicholas Berg 2 years ago, that he can bypass the traditional media, that terrorists don't necessarily need the regular television, radio, or newspapers. But rather, even when we hesitate to broadcast the most heinous scenes of violence, he understood that by using the internet, you can create a buzz, that you can still have that enormous power of horror and shock that terrorism seeks to achieve. And in that sense, I think he is one of the figures that has made the internet, particularly in the 21st century, the means of communication par excellence, or favored by terrorists and insurgents everywhere.
Well, on that depressing note, Bruce, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Bob.
Bruce Hoffman is author of the revised and expanded Inside Terrorism, recently republished by the Columbia University Press.
This week saw the end of an even longer saga, that of scientist Wen Ho Lee. The Taiwanese-American was working at the Los Alamos National Laboratory when he was accused of stealing nuclear secrets for China. He was fired in March of 1999, and the New York Times published an incriminating story, followed by more stories in the Times and elsewhere. Lee was arrested and held in solitary confinement for 278 days. Eventually, he pleaded guilty to one felony count of improperly downloading restricted data. The other 58 counts were dropped. Lee sued the Energy Department and the FBI, among others, for harm to his reputation caused by the leaks to the press. But to win his case, he needed the names of the leakers, which is why subpoenas were served to the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, ABC News, and the Associated Press. Ultimately, the news outlets chose to pay a combined settlement of $750,000. The government shelled out $895,000. So now, Lee's nightmare is over. Not so the news outlets, especially since this week the Supreme Court declined to consider whether the reporter's privilege to protect sources should extend to civil suits like Lee's. University of Minnesota media law professor Jane Kirtley is stunned by the media's preemptive payout. She says she's never known a news organization to buy its way out of a subpoena when it's not even a party to the case.
I think that this does present a very real possibility that in the future we're going to have litigants who will use this precedent. Granted, it's not binding legal precedent, but they will use the fact that journalists were prepared to do this as a way to get money.
What do you think the news organization should have done in this case?
This is one of these things that is going to alienate me from most of my other media lawyer friends. But my answer to the question is that I think in this circumstance, the news organizations really had no choice but to either go to jail or pay the fine if that was what the court imposed. Or the journalists would have to go back to their sources and see if the sources would release them from their promises of confidentiality. I would assume that they did make those requests and that they were turned down.
So basically you're saying these reporters should have been willing to go to jail to stand up for the reporter's privilege to keep their sources confidential.
I know that that sounds somewhat harsh. It sounds extremely harsh. But I think that the promise of confidentiality is one that should not be given lightly.
And they kept their promise. They merely paid to keep it. That's all.
Buying your way out of it is, to me, troubling. You know, one of the things that we used to worry about 15 years ago was people doing end runs around the constitutional protections of the New York Times versus Sullivan case that protects journalists from being sued from libel in most situations. I think this is the new end run around constitutional protections for the press. You don't even have to file your libel suit. You're going to be able to get money from the press simply by subpoenaing them and then waiting for them to buy you off.
Until the money runs out.
Until the money runs out. And, of course, that's always the problem here. Judges now seem more inclined to levy fines. I mean, when you start fining the press, then there become really significant financial concerns, which a big news organization has to think about, especially one that's publicly traded. It's one of the more troubling aspects of all of this.
You know, there's something else about journalistic practice that unites the Hatfield case, the accused anthrax doctor who turned out not to be, and the Wenho Lee case, and also the case of Richard Jewell, the so-called Atlanta bomber that wasn't. And that is, the reporters in all those cases were relying on law enforcement, either named or anonymous, for their information, and law enforcement had their own reasons for supplying information that hadn't thoroughly been checked out.
There's no question that the over-reliance on governmental sources, particularly law enforcement sources, is a really pernicious practice. Not only does it leave a journalist vulnerable to being manipulated, it also, to my mind, raises serious questions about fairness, because oftentimes the lawyers who are representing criminal defendants are constrained by ethical rules about what they can say, whereas the government and law enforcement generally takes the position that they can say anything they want. And leaks coming from law enforcement, I think, are equally, if not more, problematic. So if there's any cautionary tale that comes out of this, it's certainly that journalists should be very careful about leaving themselves open to that kind of manipulation.
But once they have been manipulated, what's the solution? How do we keep reporters out of jail for simply reporting and protect their employers from having to pay either contempt charges or settlement money?
Well, there are two options. One is to get a federal shield law. But let's face it, the reality is that for most members of Congress, this is still viewed as special interest legislation. And unless you can appeal to either their commitment to the First Amendment or their self-protection, because so many of them are leakers too, I'm not really convinced that they're going to move forward with any speed on enacting this law. The other would be to try to convince the judiciary that there really is a strong reason to provide journalists with protection that other people don't have. One of the things that has happened in the last 3 or 4 or 5 years is that we've seen greater skepticism on the part of the judiciary. They don't seem to see the role of the press as uniquely contributing to our democratic process. So until we get some judges that feel that way, I think the only real recourse we have is with Congress.
All right. Jane, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Jane Kirtley is a professor of media law and ethics at the University of Minnesota.
Coming up, when grassroots are not enough, Democrats cultivate the netroots.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week kicked off the first yearly Coast Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada, named after the hugely popular blog, The Daily Coast. Bloggers and politicians are congregating in the desert to attend workshops and panels ranging from the CIA leak investigation to, quote, down-ballot online organizing. More than anything, it's a chance for the so-called netroots, normally scattered throughout the country, to assemble and strategize in the flesh. The fact that bloggers are gathering is not unique. The fact that they are being visited by Democratic Party heavies including Howard Dean, Barbara Boxer, Bill Richardson, Tom Vilsack, Mark Warner, and Harry Reid is. It appears the Netroots have arrived. Matt Stoller is among them in Las Vegas this weekend. He blogs for MyDD.com and runs BlogPack, a Netroots political action committee. Altogether, he's an ideal candidate for articulating the meaning of Netroots.
Netroots is a term that combines the word internet and grassroots. They're people that are new actors in the political system and use the internet to make their voice heard.
Does it have a democratic connotation or does it not?
Well, I think it does. I mean, first of all, the progressive Netroots were a market response to failure to deliver good liberal information. There are already plenty of channels to find conservative information. You can watch television news. You can listen to radio. There are plenty of websites already, Newsmax, et cetera, et cetera. There are lots of newspapers, editorials, and there really weren't very many places for liberals to get information. So in one sense, the blogs first became big on the left because of that. You also have a need for new institutions on the left, and you don't have that on the right because the right controls the White House, the Senate, the House, and the intellectual debate in this country. So it's not that the internet is more prone to left-wing ideas. It's just that they don't need it as much. But you also have the fact that blue areas have higher internet penetration and more broadband, and so those people who have that are more likely to be online.
This first yearly COS managed to pull in some major Democratic leaders. What specifically can blogs and bloggers do for politicians? We know they raised a lot of money for Howard Dean during the last presidential election. We know that they were able to organize canvassers. Is that the principal goal here, to organize an army of political activists?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you look at situations going on now in Connecticut, for instance, where you have a primary, the blogs have raised a lot of money for a primary challenger to Senator Lieberman. But not just money, but also support and messaging, and have done research and have really created a public forum for debate.
You know, when Howard Dean was running strong during the last presidential race, the mainstream media declared the blogosphere a secret weapon in undiscovered country that could make or break candidates. After Dean pretty much fell abruptly from grace, the blogosphere was regarded as an overrated chimera that really didn't have much effect on campaigns at all. Do you think there was just too much rushing to judgment here?
Of course. The people who are saying that are, you know, insiders protecting their turf. You know, the Washington Press Corps and the sort of traditional Democratic establishment, they're faddish, they act like high school children, and, you know, they're not adults about these things. I mean, the blogs are new to the process, they represent millions of people coming into the process and participating, and we're not facile, we don't obsess about who's in and who's out, we don't think about things like the Clintons' marriage and whether it's important. We're not part of that whole culture of really vapid insiderism. I mean, there are millions of us, and the Gang of 500? It are the most important journalists in D.C. Like, there's 500 of them. That's not democracy. That's not what this country is about. So I don't really care what they say. I don't care what they think about this movement, because it is a movement and it represents so many more people and so much more energy. And, you know, 2 years later, after the presidential election, you know, we're still here. We're still plugging away. We're participating. You know, we're changing the country every day, and we're getting stronger, and we're learning more, and we're getting more experienced.
All right. Matt, thank you very much.
All right. Well, thanks a lot.
Matt Stoller blogs for MyDD.com. The politician most associated with the Netroots is Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean. He joins me now. Governor, welcome to the show.
Happy to be on.
Now, Netroot candidates won some and lost some in this week's elections. In a Democratic Senate primary in Montana, the Netroot favorite John Tester beat his Democratic opponent John Morrison. But in a closely watched special election in California, the House seat forcibly vacated by disgraced Republican Duke Cunningham was filled by another Republican, a lobbyist, no less. Now, that's a big loss for the Netroot Democrat, isn't it?
Well, we actually consider that a win for the Democrat. We didn't pick up the seat, but we were only a few points short. They had to spend about $6 million in a congressional race. If we can do that, we'll bankrupt the Republican Party. It was all the on-the-ground stuff that made the difference. And we didn't win, but we came very close because of the on-the-ground stuff. And the on-the-ground stuff and the online stuff are mixed closely and tightly together, because that's how you get people to knock on doors, is organizing through the Internet.
And that's what you did in your presidential campaign, plus raising a lot of money on the Internet. But then again, Governor, you didn't win.
But it had nothing to do with the Internet folks, with the Internet community. We didn't win because I didn't make the proper transition in September, when I became the front runner, from being an insurgent to being someone who could be seen as president by a large majority of Americans. It had nothing to do with the failings of the Netroot community. The Netroot community, the Internet community, made our campaign.
The Daily Coast was one of the websites that helped make your campaign, I guess, and blogger Marcos Melitzis Zuniga is the founder of The Daily Coast. Now, he and Jerome Armstrong, who worked on your campaign and founded another political blog, MyDD.com, wrote a book together called Crashing the Gate, Netroots, Grassroots, and the Rise of People-Powered Politics. And it's really critical of the Democratic Party. In fact, it's been described as a manifesto for taking back politics. Did you read it? Did you learn anything?
Well, you know, there's not much in there I don't agree with. They're a little harsh on the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party is an institution in the middle of change. And these so-called bloggers are the agents of change. It is true that they can't win elections, although they can put you in a position where you can win elections with other factors. But it's also true that we're getting to the position where you can't win without them.
But do you think that the Netroots pose the risk of dividing the party by pulling it further to the left, especially in such a conservative time?
I think it's a big mistake to talk about left, right, and center anymore. Those terms are relatively meaningless. I think what you're seeing is a reform movement and a renewal movement in the Democratic Party. And the mainstream press is always going to focus on the conflict in that renewal movement. But underneath the hood, if you look at what's happening, there's actually a fair amount of cooperation. The so-called bloggers or the Netroots community is interested in helping Democrats, even traditional Democrats, who aren't necessarily reform, if they will stand up for the kind of vision of America that America used to stand for before the right wing began governing the country. So there's a lot more cooperation between the traditional Democrats and the bloggers, as you might think, first of all. Secondly, the bloggers are the cutting edge, and we need people out there who are always pushing the envelope. But I think this term, again, of left, right, and center is essentially irrelevant in today's politics.
So as the head of the DNC, you embrace the reform elements so strongly championed by the Netroots. You find yourselves on the same page.
That's true. We do. Their politics is not the politics of personality. Harry Reid, I would say, is a fairly traditional Democratic politician. When he shut down the Senate because the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee lied about whether he was going to investigate Iraq, the response from the Netroots community was extraordinary. These folks are interested in ideals. They're not interested in personalities. And I find that very, very refreshing at a time when the mainstream press mostly dwells on personalities and personal foibles instead of actual issues. These folks on the blog, by and large, at least on the Democratic side, are issues-oriented people who want to change America for the better.
All right. Governor Dean, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Howard Dean is the chairman of the DNC. Paul Begala is a Democrat, a political analyst, and CNN commentator. He stands outside the dance going on between bloggers and politicians, but he has a stake in whether everyone gets their steps right. He'd like to see his party gain control of the House in 06 and control of the White House in 08. And Netroots is, as we've heard, part of the strategy. Paul Begala, welcome to OTM.
Thank you.
So what do you make of the likes of Howard Dean and Harry Reid making the trip to Las Vegas to address the Netroots bloggers this weekend?
I think it's great. Politicians are like Willie Sutton, the famous bank robber, right? They asked him why he robbed banks. He said, that's where the money's at. I'd rather them be spending their time with liberal bloggers, you know, than in back rooms with Washington lobbyists.
Yeah, but how soon, in your opinion, until blogs, say, rise to the level of TV, newspapers, and news magazines in terms of influencing politics? Or is this really about dollars and cents in the end?
No, I think it's a little of both. Governor Dean, when he was running for president, was the first breakthrough candidate in terms of Internet fundraising, although he didn't do very well in the primaries. He showed a way to raise large amounts of money ethically. Internet fundraising has the capacity to have very few strings attached. Because if you're only giving $25 or $200 or relatively small amounts of money from millions of people, it's mostly people who simply share your values and want to see you win.
So aside from money, what can blogs do for Democrats that the Democrats haven't been able to do for themselves?
Well, you can begin with a spinal transplant. You know, it's a difficult thing, but politicians generally, this is across the board, they generally begin, you know, the same way that entrepreneurial business people begin or anybody else who takes a risk in life. But, you know, when you get here to Washington, they become more risk averse. The more you have, the more you fear that you will lose. But a lot of the bloggers don't have anything to lose. They're sitting there with relatively low barriers to entry, low overhead costs. If they're good, they attract an audience. And so they have less to lose. And I think that the very important thing that they can do is bring a little more backbone, a little more courage, a little more spine to my party. Second, what's revolutionary in terms of media is that the bloggers on the left have begun to do what the right has been doing for 30 years, which is to try to police the media itself. There are bloggers, there are websites who track the so-called mainstream media coverage and critique it. And I think it's enormously useful.
And now liberal bloggers have written a book, or maybe several, criticizing the Democratic Party for lack of a spine. The Netroots really aren't in a position at this point to dictate to the Democratic Party, are they?
No, but it's useful to have them in the mix. You know, it's a marketplace of ideas, and if voters and the politicians believe that those observations are correct, they'll adjust to them and adapt to them. And I think they are. I mean, 3 years ago, most of the mainstream media was marching along in supporting the president's drive to war. I'm very proud that on my little much-maligned show Crossfire, Carville and I, and Bob Novak on the right for that matter, were all critics of the war and opponents of it. But today, the Netroots have grown so much bigger that I think it's a lot less likely that the majority of Democrats would go along with a war in Iraq if the vote were today.
So in your view, then, the Netroots aren't just a temporary port in the storm for Democrats until they achieve majorities again. They're a permanent and important constituency of sorts.
They are if they can prove that they can deliver. Again, Howard Dean proved that they can deliver money. I want to see that they can deliver votes. Right now, the contribution is sometimes money and very often ideas, some strategic, some tactical, some philosophical.
And labor.
But that's what I want. I want to see votes. I want to see organizers. I want to see that kind of work. And I think that that's where the next wave is. It's very hard, actually, to move people from online activism to offline activism. But that's the next step. That's what liberals and Democrats are going to have to do.
All right. Paul Begala, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
Paul Begala is a political analyst and CNN commentator.
In recent weeks, two big legal victories for netizens. In one, Anthony DeMeo III slapped Tucker Max with a lawsuit for defamatory comments posted on Max's site. DeMeo sued under a criminal statute that bars people from anonymously using a telecommunications device to harass someone. DeMeo conceded that Max did not write the offensive comments, but argued that since he did have the ability to edit or censor them, he should be legally responsible for any libel contained therein. The judge didn't buy it, writing in his opinion that he found the law must protect even, quote, the coarse conversation that it appears never ends. The second case involved several websites that came under scrutiny last year when they published leaked details of a new Apple computer device. Apple filed a lawsuit in California against the leaker, presumably an Apple employee, identified as John or Jane Doe in the brief. In order to find the leaker, Apple tried to subpoena the Internet service provider, which had access to the emails sent from the source to the bloggers. The bloggers struck back, arguing that as journalists, they are protected by California's shield laws and should not have to reveal their sources. Late last month, the judges agreed. Denise Howell is an attorney who specializes in technology issues and is a blogger, and she joins us now to discuss the decision. Denise, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
So at least in California, this clears up the question of whether what happens online is considered journalism. The judge pointedly refused to define the word journalist, but did say that whether it's happening online or in newspapers or on television, looking into matters of interest to others is by definition journalism. Is that right?
That's right. The court didn't make any absolute statement that everything that happens online is news. Far from it. But it did clarify that the shield law is intended to protect the gathering and dissemination of news, and that can certainly happen online.
Now, Apple had an argument in this case that this material did not constitute journalism. How did it support its case?
Well, Apple tried to make a technical argument under the statute that this material wasn't a newspaper, magazine, or other periodical publication. But in a broader sense, Apple tried to basically poo-poo any form of online publishing as incapable of being journalism.
That's kind of ironic since Apple is in the, what do you know, digital communication business.
That's right. It's certainly facilitating a great deal of the kind of discussion and reporting that it was attempting to cast as something other than journalism in this case.
Now, there's another element of this of keen interest to journalists, not just the definition of whether online material constitutes journalism, but how far a complainant can go to coerce an online company to divulge its sources. And the court was pretty tough on Apple on this point.
It sure was. Throughout the opinion, it's clear that the court was just unhappy that Apple had decided to use the civil discovery process to do its information gathering from third parties who weren't actually parties to the lawsuit. The decision interprets a federal law, commonly called the Stored Communications Act, and held that simply because you have a civil action pending doesn't mean you can go rummaging around in the contents of somebody's privately hosted third-party email account.
So just a brief primer here on discovery. That's the portion of the case wherein the parties are entitled to seek from the other parties, or I guess third parties, information pertinent to either their defense or the prosecution. And in this case, Apple was going to the ISPs and the websites themselves to find out who these Jane and John Does were. And the judge said, not so fast.
Exactly.
Finally, this was a state ruling in California. Is there any reason to think that this will become a standard in other states or in federal courts as well?
Well, it is a case that is only law in California, but it is also very well written and well reasoned, and there's every reason to expect that other courts will look to it as persuasive authority on this issue where there is not a lot of judicial guidance.
Okay, Denise. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Denise Howell is an appellate and intellectual property lawyer in Los Angeles who blogs at bagandbaggage.com.
Coming up, newspapers seek to right a 100-year-old wrong.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the last decade of the 19th century, North Carolina was the site of a little-known chapter in American history. For several years, a biracial coalition of Republicans and populists controlled two Senate seats, the governorship, and a majority in the state legislature. Supporters of the so-called fusion movement were mostly white, yet black men held elective office, too, in a number of counties. But all that came to a bloody end one night in November in what came to be known as the Wilmington Race Riot of 1898. White mobs set fire to black-owned businesses and overthrew the city's own fusion government that killed dozens of blacks and ran thousands out of town. In the year 2000, a commission finally was created to investigate the episode. In a report released last week, it concluded that what happened that night in Wilmington was not so much a riot as an insurrection, a coup d'etat orchestrated by prominent members of the Democratic Party. They sought to topple the fusion government, and though they had big business on their side, as well as the Raleigh News and Observer and other regional papers, that wasn't enough. They needed the poor white farmers. And so, says Duke Professor Timothy Tyson, the Democrats used the printing press to paint the conflict in black and white.
The goal was elite rule. Racial rhetoric and racial violence was a tool to that end. What you had to do then was to shame white men who had voted with black men and say that they had failed to protect their women folk, right? So they put this red-hot, scurrilous, very sort of sexually oriented, near-pornographic material out in the newspapers about the sort of black beast, black brutes, especially in the counties that had heavy black majorities. They tried to shame white men into voting race instead of sticking with their economic interests.
Can you give me some specific examples of headlines or articles or cartoons that were inciting violence and racial hatred?
Well, for example, there's a cartoon of a big black vampire-like thing with wings, the incubus of Negro domination, you know, carrying off white women in its claws. The News Observer would run a cartoon of a white woman taken before a black magistrate, for example, and the black magistrate, you know, being licentious as if, you know, oh, we're, you know, you're in trouble, are you? And then acting as though they would be sexually taking advantage of this. They interpreted any kind of self-assertion on the part of black men as really being about sexuality, you know, about taking white women.
There's a temptation to see this as kind of an interesting historical footnote, but it's more than that. It was really a watershed event for the politics and governance of North Carolina for a century.
Oh, this is the most important political event in North Carolina's history, with the exception of the Civil War. When we had a coup in North Carolina and the federal government did nothing, President McKinley never even uttered the word Wilmington. What that did was send a signal that you can run black people out of public life in the South, no holes barred, and we quickly see this happening. Georgia had a very similar campaign in 1906 that was really modeled on what had happened in North Carolina quite consciously. That becomes the heyday of lynching. This becomes the time of disfranchisement all across the South where black people lost the vote. So it's not just a North Carolina event. It's really an event of national importance.
And the newspapers in Georgia and elsewhere in the South, did they mimic the News and Observer in its racial browbeating?
The News and Observer, the Atlanta Constitution, the Times-Picayune in Louisiana, the Washington Post, all of really sort of the Democratic Party papers of that era follow this line. And this campaign broke a lot of ground with that, actually, because you don't see this type of stuff during slavery, for example. You don't see this idea in the white media that somehow the enslaved black men are a threat to white women. But when black men wished to be citizens, somehow the closer a black man got to a ballot box, the more he looked like a rapist. And you see these same images echoing into the 1970s and beyond.
Now, the commission didn't simply report what happened in this remarkable bit of history. It also offered suggestions for concrete steps that local government could take to begin to right some of the wrongs, reparations for heirs of victims and for minority business grants and so forth. But also, it suggested that the newspapers, which exist today under, you know, very different ownership and different ideology, should also address their own complicity with minority scholarships and, of course, a commitment to write about this chapter of history. Do you believe that newspapers should be in the reparations business?
I don't know. Honestly, you know, I don't think that private payments to individual citizens are really going to do much to fix the damage that's been done. And I would also just say that the News and Observer, really since 1998, on the 100th anniversary of the Wilmington Race Riot, has spent a lot of newsprint reporting on their own role back in the white supremacy revolution. The Greensboro paper and the Charlotte paper have done the same thing. So I don't think that they bear any great stigma. They've been very honest about how things were.
Well, Tim, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. Enjoyed being with you.
Timothy Tyson is senior scholar for the Center of Documentary Studies at Duke University. He's also the co-author with David Soselsky of Democracy Betrayed, the Wilmington Race Riot of 1898 and its Legacy.
Baseball fans wishing the sports steroid scandal would just go away met with disappointment in Thursday's sports section. Turns out Arizona Diamondbacks pitcher Jason Grimsley admits to taking illegal performance-enhancing drugs and has told investigators about other players also on the juice. But if those players' sins ever hit print, the news probably won't come from the beat reporters who cover them on the field every day. And that frustrates former Sports Illustrated writer Jeff Perlman. Last week in Slate, he griped that the San Francisco Chronicle's recent reporting on notorious juicer Barry Bonds has inspired no investigative zeal in baseball's ever-trusting press corps. Take, for example, a recent Sports Illustrated cover photo of St. Louis Cardinals slugger Albert Pujols, currently on track to break Bonds' single-season home run record. A swing of beauty, marveled the magazine. All hail the next home run king. Perlman's not impressed.
I'm not saying he's not a great player, and I'm not even saying he's doing things illegally. What I'm saying is, in this era after steroids, when writers across the board, including myself, were fooled time and time again, I think we really have to look at the game now with a very skeptical eye. You know, I just can't believe that. All right, here's Jason Giambi in New York City. Giambi admits he uses steroids in front of a grand jury. He loses a lot of weight. He becomes a basically impotent ball player where he can't do anything. The Yankees want to send him down to the minor leagues. Now here he is. He's hitting home runs again. He's as big as ever, as powerful as ever, playing great. And everyone's praising the guy. Nobody's questioning what went on. I'm not saying these guys are definitely using. What I'm saying is somebody, I think, needs to be digging through these guys' garbage, to be going to the pharmacies where guys get steroids in the Dominican Republic. I want to know for a fact if the stuff I'm covering and I'm watching and my kids are watching is legitimate.
So, Jeff, how do you account for the gentle treatment of Giambi and Pujols? Is it just that, say, Pujols is so lovable that reporters are giving him a pass?
I think part of it is that they're likable guys and Barry Bonds wasn't. Barry Bonds, for 20 years, has been antagonizing the media, and I think there's certainly a little bit of revenge factor here, but I think another major thing is laziness on the part of reporters, on the part of newspapers. You know, I worked at two newspapers surrounding my time at Sports Illustrated, the Nashville Tennessean and Newsday. Both places while I was there severely cut their budgets. And I just don't think newspapers are willing to spend the time, the manpower, to look into heavy, heavy issues that may not bring anything. The San Francisco Chronicle was the exception in that they devoted the time and the resources to do this story. And it was easy then for reporters like myself, you know, for SI, for ESPN, for everybody to jump on board and start poking around for Bond stuff, because thanks to Chronicle, we knew it was there. I have to say another part of it, without doubt, is steroid fatigue. You know, it's funny. A lot of ball players think that we writers love covering this stuff and that it's, you know, the story we've been waiting for and it's great. You know, the truth of the matter is it's a horrible story to cover. It's no fun. You're talking about the demise of the game that you love. You know, I'm like a lot of sports writers. I grew up sitting in front of a television with a mitt in one hand, a ball in the other, mimicking these guys. I love baseball. All these guys love baseball. And I think there's a lot of fatigue among writers who just want to move on, who just want to cover the game again, who want to be sports writers again, not investigative writers.
How much of this reluctance to ask those questions, though, is really about losing access to the players? I mean, baseball writers have to churn out stories 162 games a year.
Right. That's a good question. I mean, the thing is this. The one thing the Chronicle guys did right is they did not assign their Giants beat writer to do this story. The two guys who wrote the story, Mark Fainarwada and Lance Williams, They were not baseball beat writers. They were investigative writers. It would be very, very hard for a beat writer to do this sort of story because a baseball clubhouse is a very, 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 very difficult place to navigate. You try so hard to develop this trust relationship with these guys, and it's such a one-sided relationship. They have all the power in that relationship. They have everything you need. You have nothing they need. And if you violate any sort of relationship you made by saying, so are you using steroids? Let me ask you, you know, there are a lot of suspicions that you've been juicing. Why don't you tell me? It's dead. You lose that relationship. It's over. I covered baseball at SI from 96 to 2002. And we all knew there were guys on every team who you'd say, like, that guy's juicing, that guy's juicing. Oh, that guy's juicing. No doubt about it. It wasn't a mystery. You know, sometimes players would tell a reporter off the record, you know, and it actually presents a very interesting dilemma if a ball player tells you off the record that he's using steroids because you can't report it. You know, he's telling you this almost to protect himself in a way, and you can't even use that material to go to other players and talk about it.
You mentioned at the beginning of the interview that you'd been tricked so many times, and I get the feeling that's made you pretty mad too. Was there one particular betrayal that got under your skin?
There was one guy in particular who I can't name because nothing's been on the record, who I went to a restaurant with him during spring training, and he was a guy who I found very likable and very, you know, full of integrity and honesty, and he was a great profile. He was an outfielder in the National League, that's all I'll say. And I asked him, what about steroids? What do you think? And he gave me this long-winded answer about how it just isn't right and, you know, it's not worth hurting myself. And then I found out beyond a doubt that he's been using. And I hate that. And I hate that I covered Jason Giambi when Jason Giambi was with the A's. And I guess I was just dumb. I wrote about this lovable power hitter who's really worked his way up and he's done all these great things. And it was all a lie. It was BS. And there are other guys who really did work their way up, who really did have integrity. This is what bothers me the most. There's so many guys out there who don't use. I look at a guy like Ken Griffey on the Reds, who's 35 years old. Griffey is an honorable guy, a guy with integrity and decency who has had a brilliant career. And because guys like Barry Bonds and Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire and Jason Giambi came along and took the easy way, a guy like this or a guy like Fred McGriff, their careers are obscured. And all of a sudden, they're in that second tier of players. And it's just not fair. Those are the guys that, you know, it really hurts me for and why I think this is worth it, because it's such a violation of the decency and the integrity that most baseball players show.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Jeff Perlman is author of Love Me, Hate Me, Barry Bonds and the Making of an Anti-Hero. And since we're on the subject of what we hate about sports media, here's an old gripe of Bob's from about 5 years back.
Listening to an ad on a classical music radio station sounds like this.
It's called the Lexus Golden Opportunity. You have until September 4th to get the one that didn't get away.
Listening to an ad on an all-news radio station sounds like this.
Well, you'll feel even worse tomorrow morning if you miss Sleepy's one-day sale.
Listening to an ad on a baseball game sounds like this.
Hello?
Pokey, where are you? We're almost done with warm-ups. You're going to miss BP.
This is better than batting practice, coach. I'm downloading the opposing pitcher stats.
You mean you don't have Adelphia's power link?
Where is it inscribed that baseball game advertising copy must invoke baseball themes and imagery? Hank Greenwald, retired voice of the San Francisco Giants, spent years reading the worst writing on God's green outfield.
Here are the stolen base leaders in the National League, and this feature is brought to you by some burglar alarm company. Don't let anyone steal your prized possessions, you know, or you'll hit a home run every time when you bank with such and such. They're corny, and a lot of times you kind of cringe when you hear them.
Grand slam this, strike out that. Hockey game ads don't talk about slap shots and cross checks. Traffic report advertising doesn't trot out bumper-to-bumper gags. So how in the world do you explain this?
Swing and a long drive.
I've seen plenty of big hits in my days. No hit, though, could match the one Sue Tierney of Philadelphia made during her family reunion. Sue excited that crowd of aunts, uncles, and second cousins with a grand slam meal of hot dogs and hamburgers served on delicious Stroman rolls. So make a big hit of your own with Stroman hot dog and hamburger roll.
The voice belongs to Philadelphia Phillies play-by-play man Harry Callis, one of the most admired broadcasters in baseball, which is one of the reasons the situation is so pathetic. Philadelphia Inquirer sports writer Frank Fitzpatrick not only cringes, but feels a deep and abiding sadness to hear so distinguished an announcer reduced to mouthing such insipid and misinformed blather.
There's one of these ads that's like fingernails on a blackboard to me. It's another Stroman's ad, and Harry says, I've seen many great Phillies teams over the years, and I'm thinking, no, you haven't. I mean, they've only had five pennant winners in 117 years.
He's right, of course. The Phillies are by far the losingest franchise in the history of professional sports. But Frank veers off the point, which is that what the hell do great Phillies teams have to do with hot dog buns?
I think most of the imagery is just so cliched that they feel like no matter what bad pun or play on words they
and
make, people
forget it, Frank. I'll tell you what it has to do with hot dog buns. It doesn't have anything to do with hot dog buns. At long last, what kind of sensibility is behind this reflexive reference in the advertising to the programming that surrounds it? Pitching stats and cable modems? Who writes this stuff?
Well, obviously, knowing that this was going to be broadcast during the Dodger games, you want that type of a tie-in.
Michael Knight is marketing manager for the Adelphia Cable System's PowerLink high-speed internet service. He doesn't use an ad agency. He himself authored the pitcher spot that Adelphia runs on Dodgers games.
Major sports, say a football and a basketball, which probably wouldn't have come as easy to me to create an ad that would flow. Baseball just has that natural flow to it.
There's your answer. Baseball ads sound the way they do because the likes of Oscar Wilde aren't writing them, nor are the likes of David Ogilvy writing them. Marketing managers of high-speed internet services are writing them. Local radio ads on baseball or anywhere else are the bottom of the advertising food chain, and the author's imagination is usually insufficient to think outside the white chalk lines. But the thing is, you don't have to be peddling cable service or doughy picnic items to sound pitiful in your attempt to hit one out of the park with the consumer. You can be selling the future of New York City.
Hey, when a shortstop drops the ball on a sure double play, he tells you, my error, there's no finger pointing. So how come on a big thing like poor math and reading scores, no one in the school system has ever said, hey, it's my fault? Well, elect Mike Bloomberg mayor. Give him the assignment. He'll be accountable. Mike Bloomberg. He'll deliver.
Paid for by Bloomberg tonight.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo. And edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from George Edwards, Claire Peters, and Noah Kuman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by Ciao Bella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and fruit sorbets. Their gelato is handmade with imported Italian ingredients. More at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.